Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Don Alperin from Google and Jean-Baptiste Onofre to give any introduction to Apache Beam. Please welcome the speakers.
All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Dan Halperin. Thanks for the introduction. As you said, I work for Google, where I've been working on Apache Beam and its predecessors for the past year and a half. And I'm a PMC member for the Apache Beam Incubating Project.
And I'm JB, JB Onofre. I'm a fellow at Tellen. I'm a member of the Apache Software Foundation. And I'm working on pretty a lot of Apache project, and I'm Beam champion and PMC for Beam. So what we want to show you today is basically what is Beam and where it comes from. And the big message is Apache Beam is a unified programming model designed to provide efficient and portable data processing pipeline. So it's what we're going to show today, both in some details and also using a demo. So basically, quickly, what is Apache Beam? First, Apache Beam is a programming model. And as is a programming model, you have to be able to implement and to author your pipeline. So the programming model by itself is implemented using SDKs. Right now, you can use Java SDK, but we also have a Python SDK on the feature branch. But Beam by itself doesn't provide a new execution engine. It's leverage the existing engine. So basically, what we have in Beam is also the runners. The runners are responsible to translate your pipelines to a target execution engine like Spark, Flink, or Dataflow. So this is a quick introduction about Apache Beam first, then we'll introduce the program model.
All right. So I imagine many of you are familiar with big data and maybe even sort of the recent streaming systems. So I'll keep this quick, but I'll give a quick overview of the model. So in Beam, sort of the fundamental abstraction of data is a P collection, which is a parallel collection of data. And one of the key things about Beam that is different from many other systems is that these collections actually, all the elements have timestamps, and they're all in temporal windows. Although, of course, for sort of traditional batch data where you didn't have this, you can have sort of an arbitrary timestamp and be in the global window. Now, in Beam, of course, you need to create these P collections from something. So you have sources, which describe sort of some data set, their metadata, and readers, which read from those sources and produce these elements. And what readers do is they give you the elements, they give you the timestamps of the elements, and they give you a watermark, which is basically an estimate of how out of order these elements can be. If you're familiar with MapReduce, then you'll understand what Pardue and Group by Key are. Pardue is basically a flat map, and Group by Key is what you'd expect sort of from a reducer. We add to this side inputs, which are a concept that gives us a global view of a P collection that we can use for broadcasting and for joins. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Sort of the two things that are really new in Beam, though, aside from what I mentioned earlier, is really all this temporal stuff. So there are windowing operations that take elements that are in some timestamp and in some window, and you can reassign. And you can do this in a data-dependent way. This data dependence is sort of really crucial to getting things like user-based event time sessions, which is really one of the key use cases of Beam, both sort of internally at Google and externally all across the world. The other thing that we mix with this is triggers, which is basically how we control when data is produced. So we have streams of data coming in, there's some out of order, there's some lateness potentially, and so we want to be able to both get early results, speculative results, and actually emit final results when we believe the data is complete. So triggers are how users control that. I'm not going to talk too much more about the model itself. There are lots of talks you can read, documentation on the website. But one of the key takeaways is, with those seven primitives, we can implement a huge host of big data use cases. So everything from classic batch jobs that are sort of time and windowing aware, streaming jobs where the data, you know, is coming out of order, is coming in late, we're getting speculative results, and user-based sessions. Retractions is still on this slide. It's not implemented yet as part of the model, but it's something we're working on. So while I won't dive deep into the model, I want to give you a sense for what's going on by diving into a really simple clickstream analysis pipeline. So imagine you're interested in who's reading the Apache blog, right? So you have some, let's say, JSON-encoded analytics stream here. I've given you a sample entry that says this user was reading, you know, page 7 of the feed at this timestamp. And what you want, this is sort of very common among users, is they want to know for each visitor to the site how many pages they read in some continuous session. So maybe this user read 17 pages between 3 and 3:35 in the afternoon. Now, of course, depending on your deployment scenario, maybe you're analyzing, you know, your real website coming on, there are a couple things you want to do differently, right? You want to track the ongoing sessions, but you don't want to wait till users stop browsing to learn that they exist. So you really want some speculative output. So maybe, you know, this user's been active for 15 minutes, and we're going to say, hey, this is early, the user's not done yet, but I've seen that they've been reading 10 pages. That way you can sort of take some real-time action as you're, you know, in response to what users are doing in real time. But of course, you have this analysis, and you either you fix a bug, or you want to rerun it over your archive data from a previous live system. Well, at that point, you don't really care about these speculative results. What you want to do is analyze the data as fast as you can, get the correct final output, and you no longer care about these speculative results. So this is the pipeline that implements this, and it really has three phases. Read the data and turn it into, you know, your internal data structure for this pipeline. Then window the data into sessions, produce speculative results, group by users and count how many records are in each session. That is the core logic. And then format your data for output and produce it. And that really is the entire pipeline.
So basically, the BIM model is a unified model. So it means that you can implement both batch and streaming pipelines using exactly the same code. And basically, the difference is located on the source where you consume the data. If you use sources like Kafka, ActiveMQ, or something like that, then you will have unbounded P collection. Unbounded means that you consume on the fly, live. So you will implement a streaming pipeline. On the other hand, if you consume data from HDFS, from, I don't know, HBase or whatever, in that case, you will have a bounded P collection. So basically, you will have a batch implement pipelines.
Yep. So I mentioned earlier sort of that this stanza here is the core of the logic. So to set this up, let's look at the graph at the below. So on the x-axis, we have time, and this is the time the user is actually taking actions. If you look at it in this form, you go, oh, this is pretty easy. The user is completely inactive before 304. They're completely inactive after 325. This is very clearly just one session from those two time periods. But of course, in real streaming systems, it does not look like this. So it's important to recognize both the event time, when things actually happen, and the processing time when they get to your big data system. So if that dotted line is y equals x, with sort of very late data emphasized for visual effect, you'll see that the there's a bunch of delay sort of in the y equals negative x direction, showing you events coming in late. Additionally, that delay is not uniform over time. So maybe my user is, you know, sitting on a bus while browsing the internet, they're moving around, they're switching cellular networks, they're getting routed differently on the internet. One of your sort of analytics endpoints that's communicating to your backend goes down for a while or has a bad network link or gets rerouted, events can come in late. And that's what happened to those purple events there. So if you're analyzing this data in real time, right, real time being the y-axis here, well, at this time, which is, you know, in this example, say 318, where it intersects the graph, you say, well, I've only seen these events so far. There's one session from 304 to 310, but the, you know, this is actually early data. I don't have confidence that I've seen all the events yet that prove to me this is done. Now, sometime later, here I think it looks like the intersection point is 325. You know, now I say, okay, I've seen those two chunks of orange events. They're separated in time. This looks like two sessions to me. You know, one early on in the afternoon and one a little bit later. But finally, once you see all the data, you can realize, hey, this is actually all just one long session. It's the same events from the previous slide, after all. And the key that enables this, as I mentioned earlier, is that watermark, which is this quantification of approximately how far from the y equals x line you can be. The watermark is what you use to say, this is no longer early. This is now a real final result. Again, I won't dig into this much more, but this is just to give you the sense of the concepts. So thinking about as a user, right? This is my pipeline. This is what I want to do. You have your streaming job, consuming your Kafka stream in real time. Your user load, let's imagine it's pretty even over the day. So you have 10 workers running, pipeline lag of a few seconds. And you know, maybe the course of the day you get a couple million visitors. So I'm making these numbers up, right? But I had 2 million users. Let's say they had about one, some of them came back, 5% of them came back, so you have about 2.1 million sessions. But because you're setting these speculative early results, hey, there's a user now, right now, reading the website. There are some early sessions and some final sessions that are sent to whatever downstream computation you do. And of course, if I have 10 workers alive for the whole day, 240 worker hours in this job. Now, tomorrow I'm going to analyze, you know, last month's data in some slightly different way. Maybe I fixed a bug. Maybe I just want to rerun the results to validate things. So now I have the same events, maybe either in a bounded window on Kafka or on, you know, a Hadoop cluster somewhere, HDFS cluster. So I'm going to spin up, say, 200 workers, run them for half an hour, read the exact same input data, but, you know, I'm trying to process it really quickly. So I no longer care about those early results. Maybe I only produce, say, that 2.1 million final sessions. And because I used 200 workers for 30 minutes, I've used 100 worker hours of sort of resources in my cluster. And I imagine that everyone who's running streaming systems and has this kind of data has done something like this in the past. So the real question is, as a user, what do you have to do to get these two different execution systems, right? The answer is really change 10 lines of code and on the command line. So, you know, you change the lines of code you change are where you're reading from and where you're writing to, and the command line arguments are basically configuring which runners you use or things like that. And we'll show you a small demo of that later. So a quick summary of this intro part, we gave you a very brief idea of Beam. We showed you a sample pipeline. I alluded to the fact that there's portability here across sort of the same code working with different IOs and different runners. I want to very briefly dive into efficiency. So anybody who's running these systems is aware of sort of the problems of what happens with real data workloads. So in a streaming system, you know, users visit your website in some diurnal pattern or some other sort of social-based system or process-based system, and so the input to your pipeline varies. Or in a batch job, you have a multi-stage job with lots of different phases. The first one is I/O bound, the second one's compute bound. You need more resources for different parts of your job. Very common problems. And of course, what we often have to do today is make a fixed decision. So if you're provisioning your cluster for your streaming system, you estimate your peak load, you set up all these machines, and then all that time between those two lines is sort of idle resources. Or you aim for the average case, as on the right, and then during peak loads, your system lags a bit. This makes you very unhappy. So the ideal behavior, of course, would be some sort of scaling up and down as your load changes in a reactive way. Batch, there's a very similar analogy. So I think the straggler problem is pretty well known. Imagine I have some job, I divide it into tasks, I assign those different tasks to different workers, and in reality, this work is unevenly distributed. It could be because the data is unevenly distributed and I couldn't split it perfectly. It could be because there's data-dependent processing, so that even splitting the input based on bytes works well, but the processing is asymmetric. It could be because of runtime effects, like one worker is just slow or has a bad network link. The other thing is, in a multi-stage job, these effects are cumulative. So I have all this idle time in the graph here, and if there's more stages, there'll be more idle time. So there's lots of standard workarounds, of course. Split the files into equal bytes and avoid this sort of uneven data. Preemptively oversplit a bunch so that, you know, I have many more tasks than I have machines, and I can just reallocate those tasks as machines come up and down. Maybe you find the slow workers, you kill them, and give their work somewhere else. Maybe you do some sample-based splitting to try to produce really even tasks. But in reality, none of these work. So, you know, as one example, oversplitting often introduces a bunch of system overhead. So really, none of them solves the problem. And this has led to, in Beam, this mantra that really, there's no amount of upfront heuristic tuning you can do that's good enough. The system always going to have something funky happen at runtime. So what you want to build is systems that are able to adapt dynamically and get out of these bad situations. So I want to give you one taste of how Beam readers enable this. So, as I mentioned, sources are metadata about some set of data, and readers are the things that read from those things and produce elements. So a bounded reader, you know, I'm going to read this range in this file, is able to tell you its progress, right? What fraction of my input have I consumed? An unbounded reader, say reading from Kafka, is able to give you an estimate of its backlog. So, you know, how far behind my Kafka stream am I? Am I keeping up or not? And then the runners can use these signals and decide, hey, I'm progressing really well. Maybe I can scale down. There's no backlog. I can scale down. Or, hey, I'm following behind, so I need to spin up some more workers and reassign some work. And the way we do this, in the bounded case, we have some work stealing APIs. So basically, you know, your source defines some metadata about a file, and I say, you know, I'm reading the first meg of this file, but I've only gotten 10% in. The runner can say, hey, cut off the second half of that file. I'll give it to another worker. And then you have this nice way to sort of rebalance the work. To give you a quick example of how this works, imagine this is some, you know, batch job running over time, different workers on the y-axis and time on the x-axis. So the red line is now, and basically all those green tasks are tasks I've completed. Those four yellow tasks are the tasks that I'm currently working on. Based on the size of those tasks and the progress through them and how long they've been running, I'm predicting those tan bars. This is how long I think these tasks will take. Now, if I add up the runtime of all those tan bars, I can estimate that if I had the work perfectly balanced, that sort of pink line would be the balancing point. So what I do, given this, is say, hey, I'm going to invoke those dynamic splitting APIs and say, please cut off the end of your chunk. And then I can give those chunks to workers where I think there's going to be idle resources. And I can iterate this over time so that I get a nice balanced execution. So this is one of the beam runners using these APIs. I have, you know, 400 workers on the y-axis running a two-stage job, reading from files, shuffling and writing those files back out. And you can see is even though I chunked the files into equal size chunks on the x-axis, there was some imbalance in the execution. Then, because I have this shuffle on a separate stage, everyone has to wait for the last task to complete, somewhere around here, and there's lots of white idle time. And the second stage, which is a shuffle, which is generally often unbalanced, we have sort of even more asymmetry. So if we turn on dynamic work rebalancing, and the runner is able to adapt in real time, what you see is a couple of things. The first thing is you see a lot less white. You see the gap between stages, the white between stages is much reduced. The second stage, which is shuffle-based, is really well balanced. And all of this on the right is savings, where your job ran a lot less time, you freed up those resources for other workers. One of the things I want to convey here is that these are core Beam APIs. They're not specific to any runner. Only two of the runners today implement them, the Direct Runner and Google's Dataflow Runner. But these are things we're hoping to get into every single Beam runner there is.
So thanks, Dan, for this introduction and overview about the Beam program model. Now we're going to see more details about the Beam incubator process, where we are, where we came from, and what the relationship between Beam and all the Apache projects. So first, where Beam came from. Things started in 2004 when Google published the MapReduce paper. And this paper described how we can efficiently process big data. And at that point, things split in two parts. Google still improved and implemented the MapReduce paper on their own. So they created things like Flume, MyWheel, and all this stuff. And on the other hand, we have some development performed based on this paper at Apache. So Hadoop, Spark, Flink, and all this stuff. And later, Google created the Google Cloud Dataflow, which is the latest iteration of all that has been started before. And so this data flow started in 2014.
So we alpha in late 2014 and sort of released in August 2015.
Yeah, and so now things converge again because Beam is basically the data flow SDK at the origin. And now Google thought that it makes sense to have an abstraction of a program model and to be able to provide this at Apache and be able to leverage the other Apache projects. So that's why Apache Beam has been created. So the vision we have in Beam is to address different people in Beam. The first users are, of course, the end users. So basically, there are people that create the pipelines. It could be you, because you have some big data processing you want to implement, and you can directly use the Beam program model and the Beam SDK. But we want to also to address the SDK writers. By SDK, it means that today we have the Java and Python SDK. You want to implement your own SDK or new SDK, then we provide all the utils you need to implement this. Related to SDK, you have all the extensions. So we can imagine transformation of function that you can use in your pipelines. This function can be generic and reused by all the people. So instead of doing it on your own, you can provide directly in Beam as an extension of the SDK. Of course, the runner writers. So we have different people who wrote some runners here. The purpose of a runner is really to translate the Beam code into something dedicated to the execution. The IO providers, so you have to consume or produce data from somewhere. So IO are basically connectors. So maybe in Beam right now, we don't provide the connectors you need. Then you can create your own connectors and your own IO. And finally, the DSL writers. Basically, you want to create a DSL on top of the SDK. So let's say, I don't know, based on a language, based on business domains, for instance, then you can create your DSL on top of the SDK. So Beam entered into the Apache incubator in February this year. The code donation came from, of course, Google, but we also had part of Beam coming from all the, let's say, providers, like Apache Flink, so people from directly the Flink community and data artisans especially, the Spark Runner coming from Cloudera Labs, and so the initial podling based on that is a mix of different contribution coming from Crudera, Data Artisan, Google, PayPal, and Talent. So since the beginning of Beam in TV Incubator, we have different people from different organizations. So the first month was the bootstrapping. Okay, so the code donation is great, but we had to change, rename packaging, remove some Google dependencies, split the artifact. It was the first step. But since the beginning as well, we wanted to see a lot of contribution on Beam. So that's why we focus on the contribution guide. And so you can find the contribution guide itself, but also all the getting started, the Jira and all this stuff that we created since the beginning. And another thing that we decided during the incubation is basically to submit a patch to Beam. You submit a pull request public, and we do, by we, I mean the Beam community, do the review, and once it is okay, when the discussion has been done, then we flag the pull request as look good to me, and then we merge into the Git repo. So at the beginning, actually, if you take a look on the Dataflow SDK, in the Dataflow SDK, you have two artifacts, the SDK itself and the example, that's all. But in Beam today, you can see that we provide a bunch of artifacts, and the Dataflow artifacts are only a runner and, let's say, some I/O like a Bigtable, BigQuery, all I/O dedicated to Google. So basically, you can see that these artifacts are a small part of Beam compared to the original code. And you can also see some artifacts coming from other Apache-related community, like the Flink runner here and the Spy runner. And also some IOs, some IO for Kafka, IO for HDFS, which are provided by the community as well. So since the June release, so in June we did the first release, the first thing we can note is we had a lot of contribution coming from the community. So we had a new SDK, Python. We have new IOs, so for JMS, for JDBC, MongoDB, extra. We have new extension, and we also have two new runners, Apache Apex and Apache Gearpump. This is not performed by the original Beam people. It's performed directly by Thomas for Apex and Manu for Gearpump, so directly by the Gearpump and Apex community. We also had new committers, one from Google, Thomas from DataTorrent and Apex is a new committer. GC Anderson, who is a new committer more from user experience and user documentation. We also improved the documentation of a release process to allow anyone in the Beam community to participate in the release. And the third release we did came from two different organizations and has been performed by three different people. We also, that's the reason why we are here. We also increased the number of talks and meetups we did to explain what is Beam, to explain to you as a user or contributors what is Beam and how you can jump in. And Beam, of course, is an Apache project, so it's owned by community. It's a project where we really focus on the contribution coming from the community and growing the community. So today, if you take a look, we have more than 1,500 messages on the mailing list. We have 500 mailing list subscribers. Remember, we started in February, okay? We have 4,000 commits on Git. We have today 950 Jira. And you can note that we got something like 1,350 pull requests, which is the second biggest number of pull requests at Apache. Okay, so that's, you can see there that since February, we did a lot of job, I think, and we improved a lot the contribution. This graph shows you, this is the green line, is the time of the incubation. So it was in February this year. This is what happens at Dataflow. So the green graph, the blue graph, is the number of contributors from Google. The red one is the number of contributors outside of Google. And the orange one is the total. So you can see that before Beam, at Dataflow. So Dataflow has been released publicly on GitHub by Google on December 2014. And so most of the contributors came from Google, was at Google. And some pull requests came from other people. Since the incubation, of course, at the beginning, we still have more people from Google. But since June, you can see that the number of contributions outside of Google increased. And so now, we have basically parity. We have at least the same number of people from outside Google and from Google in terms of contribution, which is, I think, a very good success in terms of Apache project and incubation process. So now, Dan will show you a demo of Beam. So I'll let you introduce the content of the demo itself.
All right. So I've made you a bunch of sort of reasonably bold promises that, you know, you can take code and just by changing the command line arguments, you can write it in lots of different ways. So I thought I'd give you a quick example of, you know, the standard big data demo, which is counting words in a small file. And, you know, so this is a sort of user-facing, heavily commented Beam program to do word count. And so the core of this is down here in the main function. So we're going to say, okay, I have, you know, I have some command line arguments. I'm going to build a pipeline from those arguments and set them up to run word count. I'm going to go create a pipeline. Now, what do I want to do? Well, I want to read some input file and read all the lines out of it. I want to count the words. I want to convert those counts, which is going to be a word and a long, into some string that is user understandable. And then I want to write those counts to a file. So that's, you know, the entire pipeline. And then I'm going to run it. I'm going to wait until it finishes to make it easy on the users. Now, one thing you see here is you see, okay, textio.read from file, textio.write to file, and then, you know, this count words. So count words is kind of interesting. It's a composite transform. So a transform here says I'm a reusable piece of code. I have some input signature, in this case, a collection of strings, and some output signature, a collection of strings and longs. And the way I define this transform is actually itself another series of steps in the model. So I take in my input lines, and I'm going to run my extract words function on them, which is, you know, split the lines, trim it, drop empty strings, emit the tokens. Then I'm going to use a group by key, you know, a count per element, which internally is a group by key with a count like you'd expect. And then that'll produce for each of my words, you know, a count, and then I'm going to emit that. And all of this will also transparently work with window data, data in sessions, and things like that. So this is what you see when you run the pipeline. This is when you author the pipeline. You can see in here there's no code that says this is Flink code, this is Spark code. We're just using Beam concepts. So I have here on the command line, I've actually sort of run the, we have a bunch of archetypes, right? So I did Maven generate on my archetype, and I, you know, this is the starter project. And so if I go into the source folder, you see there's, you know, a couple examples. There's the word count example, which is the one I showed you, and then there's sort of two other examples. There's a debugging word count showing you how to access other features of the model and let different sort of logs and things like that. There's the minimal word count where we drop all the comments. We try to make it look really concise and simple. And then there's the word count example itself. So I have over here, I have some scripts, which, you know, you can see nothing secret about them. But so this is the command line to run word count on the direct runner. So the, and I wish it hadn't started. So if I look here, you know, okay, it's standard Maven stuff. Maven compile exec, because exec doesn't pick up stuff in your class path well if you don't do this. Go run the word count example. And the arguments for this are read the POM for this example, and output to the folder direct counts, and profile here direct runner. So I'm just saying, you know, enable the direct runner in this profile. So you see some output, hey, I started this up. I'm some debug information, hey, I'm expanding a file pattern. I found one file that matches the pattern POM XML. I'm initializing some write operations. This is all debug code that you see in the direct runner, and I succeeded. And, you know, if I look in the output, oh, I got five files here. And the reason you get five files, the direct runner wants you to realize that most of these systems are distributed. They are going to produce your output in multiple files. You shouldn't assume you get the data, you know, all in one file. And in fact, if I run it again, I might get three files or four files. We sort of add some randomness here so that users understand what working with big data actually is. If I look at one of these files, you see just a bunch of records. They're actually not ordered because, again, in distributed systems, most of these records will not be ordered. It's going to be up to the order things come out of the shuffle or things like that. But of course, if I cat, you know, everything and then I sort it, you'll see, oh, okay, you know, I have 68 instances of the word version. I have, I don't know, you know, Surefire shows up. I have Spark a couple times. I have 22 scopes, you know, the typical POM stuff. So that's the direct runner. So what about Apex? Well, let me copy and paste. So the first line is entirely the same. The second line is the changes. So now we same input file. The output is now Apex counts instead of direct runner counts. I have another flag here that says use the Apex runner, please. So we've hard-coded the direct runner as the default if you don't specify. And then I turn on the Apex runner profile, which enables the, you know, Apex modules and that kind of thing. So when I hit enter here, this is going to run Apex in embedded mode. So again, I'm going to compile the code and do some Maven crap. Now you see logging. Now it's going to actually set up a checkpointing thing, start Apex, doing some heartbeats, all kinds of stuff happening. I don't know Apex well enough. There's a Stram child launcher. Is that supposed to be Stream? I don't know. We'll find out.
You can note there that we didn't change anything in the code itself. It just changed the execution.
And you can see, right, we spun up Apex, we spun down Apex, we had a buffer server, all these kinds of things. And if I look in the Apex folder, whoa, 239 files. So Apex is a much streamier runner than the direct runner is. In fact, Apex doesn't, I think we were talking the other day, Apex doesn't have sort of a pure batch mode where it tries to be much more efficient because it's aiming for streaming. And so my guess is, I haven't actually verified this yet, so we'll see if I'm right on the fly. Apex counts 59. My guess is it's one word per file. That was going to be my guess because, you know, the keys here are sort of the fundamental operation of parallelism in these streaming systems. But of course, if I, you know, look at all the files and I sort, then, oh, 68 versions, you know, whatever it was, 22 scopes, just what we expected. All right, let's do it again, right? So this is the Flink version, and you can see the three changes were Flink, Flink, and Flink from Apex, Apex, and Apex. Again, we're running Flink in embedded mode. You see some maps and some counts. Especially for the runners that are newer, there's a lot more debugging output because in general, we're still, you know, confirming that everything's correct. So one thing you see here, this is actually wrong right now. Whoops, where's my cursor? This is actually wrong. I think there's 25 empty lines in this file. But this metrics API is sort of a side API. It's an optional runner API that lets users get stats about their program. And this API got broken probably by us a couple weeks ago when we changed some stuff around. But the output is still going to be correct. And, you know, we're working on making sure we integrate, you know, the monitoring, the metrics, the accumulators, all this stuff across different runners. So one more time, if I look at Flink, Flink has said, you know, hey, there's only one file, it's small, let's just run this whole thing in one batch. And I believe Flink also sorts sort of internally, that just happens. And so you get the same file, same outputs, everyone's happy. You know, let's do it for Spark. This, we have a little bit more here. So we had, for Spark, we actually specified the same output, the same Spark runner. We also said, you know, use the local Spark master. And I turned on the event log. So, you know, right now this is running Spark. You see all kinds of things happening. Of course, if I look at the Spark output directory, I also only get one file. I believe Spark, however, does not sort. You know, I can sort it, and you'll see 68 versions, 22 scopes. Everyone's happy. But I turned on the event log so I could also show you, you know, this thing, right? So this is an earlier one. What time is it? 11:32. So it'll be this run. And, you know, I can go use all my standard Spark stuff to look at this. I can, you know, explore the DAG of the different stages, all the things you expect to see. And if I go down here, I believe, into the more details, then you'll see.
Actually, Spark doesn't know that the code comes from Beam. For Spark or for Flink, it's exactly a regular Spark code or Flink code. The fact that the runner translates the Beam code to something specific to Spark is a runner concern, not a Spark concern.
Right, and in fact, this is sort of this is an example of that. So, of course, you have to read your stack traces upside down. But you know, when I run the pipeline, the Spark runner kicks in and walks over the pipeline and visits all the nodes in the graph and says, oh, I recognize this, I recognize that. I'm going to turn this group by key into that. And so that's how it builds sort of the RDD graph here. And so, I don't know, this is some part of the pipeline. I believe in at least one of these, you get to see, if you look around, you get to see somewhere. Here, this says, saying, you know, hey, this RDD is readlines.out. So if I go back to word count, you know, I called this stage here read lines, and so that RDD is sort of taking this step called read lines, taking the output of that, and that is sort of the name of that RDD. So we're working on, you know, how you link the things that Beam has, like labeling all these collections, into the runner-specific interfaces. Now, so far, all of these have actually spun up the runner and sort of turned it down inside of the job. And so you imagine, okay, word count shouldn't take 10 seconds, but that's because I'm starting all this stuff. So, of course, I also have a Flink cluster version. So, you know, Flink, like I think Hadoop and many other Apache projects, you have to build these fat jars with your sort of specified executable in them. So, you know, it's running, it's building a fat jar, and then in a second, it's going to produce for me a fancy, you know, word count target jar type of thing. So there's my word count beam, the original one before we shaded it. And I have Flink 1.1.2 here, which is, I think, the next to last version of Flink. We haven't upgraded yet. I told it to run that word count jar. Again, same command line arguments. Input file pom, output, this time I called it Flink cluster counts, runner Flink runner. And that is actually by default going to run against the local job manager on my laptop. So I actually have in a separate process, I have Flink running. This time I think it'll be much faster because it didn't spin up and spin down Flink. If I go back to my web UI here, of course these jobs are very fast, 1135, that's this one. So you can see, you know, now you can see how Flink is expressing this pipeline into different Flink operators, and things like that. I don't know Flink all that well, but I know a little bit, right? So, and you'll see that, like, you know, it's done things like say, hey, I have a map, a combine, and then a map, and all that gets sort of inlined into one operator, so different runners can optimize in sort of their runner-specific ways.
So, yeah, it's something important, for example, in the Spark runner, when we translate the logical DAG that you define in your pipeline into some execution DAG, the runner can decide to do some optimization for you. So it's not just a translator, it's a translator plus eventually some optimization.
Yeah. And again, I don't know this web UI, but you can see this is some sort of Gantt chart, right? Different operators and when they're scheduled, no exceptions, that's good. I don't know. So if this is stuff you understand, good. I don't super understand it. The last thing I want to do is, it seems like we're doing okay on time, so I will. Is run it on Dataflow.
So just before jumping on Dataflow, sorry, then you can do exactly the same with Spark using the Spark Summit. So you can create your own jar and use the regular Spark Summit to submit on your cluster. So it will work exactly the same.
Yep. Okay. So, you know, Dataflow is a cloud-based runner. It's a little bit more complicated to get started. At least the command line is a little bit more complicated. So you look at this again, the exact same first line as before. This time I've moved the input to Google Cloud Storage, because guess what? The VMs in the cloud cannot read my local hard drive. Again, I've moved the output to Google Cloud Storage, used the Dataflow runner, some cloud project, some temp file location on GCP, and Dataflow runner. But again, you know, the bulk of this is change the word Flink runner to Dataflow runner, and then add some runner-specific command line options. It's sort of the same pattern everywhere. All runners are on completely equal footing. So Dataflow, I'm deliberately talking slow because as a cloud thing, it's a little bit interesting. So I don't know, what can you see here? We actually are doing things like you don't have to make a fat jar. We just scan your class path and upload some stuff. So that would have happened up here. There's my cursor. It actually took the 84 jars on my hard drive and uploaded them. And of course, it doesn't actually upload them all if they're already there. And I believe they're probably all already there. It says right here, one of them was newly uploaded, probably the one I just compiled. And then, you know, our version of a web UI, Dataflow's version of a web UI, looks like this. This was a trial run this morning. And again, you're going to see that it's slow, because what's happening is it's a fully managed service. We actually are spinning up VMs on Compute Engine right now. Fundamentally, like, it's, you know, we have three different runners here. They all have web UIs. They're all doing sort of cool things. And Dataflow is just another instance of this. And so the VMs are still running. You can see the graph structure over here. But you can see why I potentially was going to defer this demo, because, in fact, it's already been over a minute, and the VMs aren't up yet. And I don't know. You can see some other things. In a second or two, the VMs will start, and we'll start seeing, you know, the logs of the job. And so the other thing here, The other thing we're doing, so I mentioned in Spark how, you know, we're sort of able to map the user-facing names of things and sort of show them in their UI. So again, that same kind of stuff shows up here. Obviously, it's a little bit mature, but only because Dataflow is earlier. So we're working really hard to make sure every runner gets on completely equal footing with respect to these types of operations. I don't know why the VM hasn't come up yet. Maybe there's someone running a huge job. Maybe the network here is funky. I got no idea. But it'll come up in a bit. What is this? Oh, it's so okay. Over here, it apparently actually has already stopped. So maybe my web browser is just, you know, having some corporate Wi-Fi stuff. None of the other ones depended on the network working. And that was probably a smooth strategy. Okay, so now everything's green, and you can see the... I was going to show you empty lines is what I wanted to show. So down here, you'll see the user-facing aggregators. Oh, it's actually 30, not 25. So this is, you know, again, Flink... Flink on the console printed out the empty lines accumulator. We broke that in the last week or so, but you see the same thing here. And the idea is to provide a really sort of nice uniform experience across all the different runners. So I think that will conclude the demo portion. And I'll hand it back over to JB to wrap up.
Yeah, so why beam at Apache? Well, maybe a question. The first thing is... by the model itself, as Dan explained, we have some, let's say, feature, interesting feature, like correctness, all about windowing, watermarking, and all this stuff. It's really something valuable that the Prime model provide. And it's pretty interesting because right now there are a lot of other Apache projects that use this model for their own implementation, like, for instance, Flink. It's also portable. It's portable, as you can see in the demo, from a runner perspective. So exactly the same code will work on different runners. But it's also portable in terms of, let's say, backend execution. During the demo, we run on local machine, but we also run on the Dataflow cloud platform, which is a cloud solution. It's unified, so it's exactly the same code that you can use to address both batch and streaming pipelines. The only difference is where you consume the data. And of course, we want to use the Apache community as a network effect. By network effect, it means that we count on other Apache communities to help us and join the Beam effort. Apex did that, Flink did that, so you have a lot of, we can see a lot of potential relationship with other Apache projects.
Yep, I mean, I really want to emphasize this, right? You know, network, there's really a quadratic gains here for the project, and this is really why we as Google wanted to join Apache and form this Beam project. So, you know, users should have to write their pipelines once, not once per runner. You know, Kafka should have to write a really good client for one system or three systems, but not one for every system. Et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, I really believe that this is a sort of a unifying layer and a way to provide a really nice experience to the whole ecosystem.
So where we are right now and what's the next step for the Apache Beam incubator? The first thing, the target is to graduate as a TLP. The purpose is to give more visibility to Beam and to empower the user adoption. I mean, we got some feedback that Beam is great, but before a top-level project, I can really use it. The other step we want to do is to really grow the user community, and the website is one of tools we have to provide and improve. So the website, we're going to improve the look and feel, of course, but also the content, providing more straightforward samples and documentation to allow you to easily start with Beam. We want also to improve the user experience, the way of submitting your pipelines to different, let's say, cluster or using the runner. So the way of submitting and managing your jobs is pretty important in Beam. And we can provide, I think, interesting tool on top of the existing runners and execution engine. And keep growing, of course. Okay, right now we have... potential new runners in mind. I mean, MapReduce runner, Storm runner, we can see a lot of different potential runners. Also, start some DSL, maybe an SQL DSL using Calcite. That could be interesting. New IOs, there are already some IOs in preparation, like Apache Cassandra, Elasticsearch. But any, again, is use case and community oriented. So if you have some ideas or some requirements, just provide a pull request or jump on the mailing list on the Jira, and we're going to implement this with you.
And I want to give a shout out that in this room, not the next talk, but the talk after, there will be a Shio talk, which is this DSL that integrates well with Beam. So if you want to learn more, you know, we have websites. We have a contribution guide. We've got mailing lists. We've got a blog. We've got a Twitter. And, of course, we're here for your questions. Please come join us. And I think we have at least 5 minutes for questions. And so we're going to wrap up now. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.